Welcome to Dialogues in Afro-Latinidad, a podcast dedicated to amplifying and elevating Afro-Latinx histories, cultures, and communities across the Americas and beyond. I'm your host, Dr. Michelle Reed Vasquez. Join us for conversations with experts and artists to learn more about Afro-Latinidad. Venga. Hi, our guest today is Dr. Amalia Dache. Dr. Dache is an Afro-Cuban American scholar and associate professor at the University of Pennsylvania. Her experiences as a 1980s Mario boat lift refugee and as a student navigating U.S. inner city schools, community college, state college, and a private research-intensive university contribute to her lines of inquiry. Dr. Dache's major research areas are post-colonial geographic contexts of higher education and Afro-Latino, Latina, and Latinx studies. She has won numerous awards and fellowships from the National Academy of Education, the Spencer Foundation, the Association for the Study of Higher Education, and the Rockefeller Institute. Dr. Dache has appeared as an expert in film, international, and national media outlets. Amalia, welcome to the Dialogues in Afro-Latinidad podcast.
Thank you so much, Michelle, for having me.
So we're going to jump right in. So I know you were born in Cuba and came to the U.S. when you were about 3 years old. How did your interest in exploring the visibility, the experiences of Afro-Latinos evolve? What's your origin story?
Yes. So the origin story would most likely be the fact that I navigated schools in a way that always was pretty tense. So being Cuban, because like in the 1980s and 90s, having both Afro and Cubanidad together didn't really exist in the United States. That term didn't exist for me as a young person. Mm-hmm. And so in Rochester, New York, which is where we were relocated by a Catholic organization in the 80s after Mariel, we were in neighborhoods that were predominantly Puerto Rican and African American in the northeast of Rochester. And so there was very little Cubans. So I thought Cubans looked like us. I thought Cubans looked like my mom and dad, like as a young person. But when I started going to school and I realized, because I didn't see any Cubans, all I saw was Puerto Ricans and African Americans. And so I was always kind of between this binary of, well, I don't look like the people who speak like me and go to church with me, right? The Puerto Ricans. But I look like the people who don't speak my parents' language and my language and eat the kind of foods that I do. But still, like, our hair is the same, right? And as a girl, you know, it's like the hair thing, you know, should I straighten my hair? Should I? So I figured out that I was this, you know, this unique, you know, kind of person in schools. I was in bilingual programs and I was culturally, you know, aligned with the Puerto Rican community. But when I started dating as a young person, I dated African-American men because Puerto Rican men weren't interested in me as a young. And I started to figure it out and conclude that it had to do with my skin color and it had to do with my hair texture. And so I was preferred for African-Americans and I was not preferred for Puerto Rican men. And so my social circles were predominantly African-American. And so my best friends were African-American women and going to college consisted of learning about HBCUs. And so kind of my Black identity, you know, aligned with kind of U.S. African-Americanness. And then my kind of Latino identity always was, you know, trying to figure out, you know, how cool I am for the Puerto Ricans or, you know, if they would hang out with me. But it typically, you know, meant that socially I wasn't pretty accepted in the Puerto Rican community. They weren't mean. But when the Dominicans came, in the like early 90s in Rochester, I was like, oh, these people look like me. And so, you know, the Dominicans became my cousins. Like, so, you know, the girls in the school became cousins. And so, again, we didn't talk about Afro-Latinidad, but we did realize that we were a different skin color, that we were different phenotypically from the Puerto Ricans, at least in upstate New York and Rochester. And that made us unique, but we never talked about race directly. But in your follow up questions, I'll kind of add layers to, you know, why that is and how my kind of personal family spiritual life was always a part of being kind of like Afro-Cuban. But what that meant to me was quite different than what I was navigating at school.
Okay. Spoken like a researcher with the follow-up questions, you know they're coming. and speaking of, so I want to talk about, try to dig in a little bit more then, of course, thinking about some defining moments in that. Like you mentioned a bit about the arrival of the Dominican immigrants and aha, here's a group that, you know, that are clearly very related to your racial makeup, your ethnicity. But what are some moments in that journey that we really were like, this is it. All I see, I know what's going on. Yeah.
Well, I think like intellectually, intellectually is where the bulk kind of hit me when one major moment was, so I grew up in an Afro-Cuban. When I say Afro-Cuban, I mean also ethnically and spiritually, because my father was one of the first paleros, palo mayumberos. I think you're probably familiar. You do work in Cuba. We know that there's santeros, babalaos, ifa orisha on the Yoruba side. But then we also have on the Bantu side, the paleros who practiced Bantu traditions. So my father was a palero. And he was probably one of the first, if not the first, palero in Rochester and upstate New York. And he started consulting and doing, you know, spiritual work in this largely Puerto Rican community, I think primarily. I think secondarily was African-American, but he also had African-American clients. And so having a spiritual healer in the community that was a palero, but that also with Palo Mayombe, because of Afro-Cuban syncretism, orishas and Yoruba traditions are also mixed in. Mm-hmm. It's a very hybrid, even though the rituals are palo, our spiritual practices include the orishas. And so, you know, I was raised with thinking the gods and goddesses were extensions of the Catholic Church. Mm-hmm. So church to me was one thing. And then at home, you know, we had orishas and spirits that were African, and we spoke in traditional Bantu or Yoruba, you know, dialects when we were doing rituals. And so that was being Afro-Cuban, right? Or being Cuban, right? Because again, mm-hmm. we didn't realize later when I saw more Cubans that didn't look like us, that we had particular traditions and cultural practices that were based in Africa. And so, yeah, I think that, you know, being initiated in that religion as a young person, as a 12-year-old, right? Mm-hmm. Knowing that the ancestors protected me and that I had a larger celestial, let's say, community mm-hmm. of people who were in this world and people who were in another world. I always felt protected. I always felt that, that I was doing things that were bigger than just me, that it was part of a destiny and a journey. And so when I was in grad school and I would read about kind of Caribbean literature or African literature, for example, literature from Nobel laureates that, you know, drew from the Caribbean, I saw similarities. I was like, oh, wow, you know, they're talking about, you know, these African spiritual practices that, you know, that I practiced growing up as a Cuban and Afro-Cuban. And so I began exploring that and realizing that kind of like anthropological work that Fernando Ortiz, mm-hmm. specifically Lilia Cabrera, El Monte text was actually a text that was in my house that I saw and I read growing up, not even knowing that it was anthropological. I thought it was a spiritual ritual text because my dad would read it to get chants and to get kind of, because she detailed extensively Palo Mayombe religion and spiritual practices in El Monte. And so I remember writing for grad school once, like, you know, Lydia Cabrera's El Monte was, you know, was more important to us than the King James Bible, even though we were, you know, we were Catholic. So I think those were defining moments for me about, you know, what it meant to be Afro-Cubana or Cubana, those African traditions, and then seeing them kind of in bodies of scholarship mm-hmm. and seeing that I existed in that way.
Wonderful. I know in terms of Afro-Latinidad that you're really passionate about Afro-Cubanidad and the human rights struggle in Cuba and gender issues. So if you could tell us a little bit more about these aspects and how they're central in your work.
Sure. So as we know, I don't know if you know, most people should know, but we know how the media is in the United States. It has its preferences politically. And Cuba tends to be a political football for the left and the right. And so the Cuban human rights struggle is at the heart of so much of what I talk about in the media. And the book that I'm working on now is based on an ethnography that I did in Cuba in 2018, which was the last time I was in Cuba, on the educational experiences of Havana Cubans. And I extended that to the United States to look at the Marilitos and the Balseros and their educational experiences. And a lot of what I found was that the older generations had these ancestral traditions and these practices, these Afro-Cuban practices, so babalaos, santeros, could talk intellectually and could talk in a way that kind of expanded this idea of education from beyond the university. And also, a lot of these practitioners were not university participants or students in Cuba. I also realized that those that were in the university were largely aligned with the political regime in Cuba, or had to be aligned with the political regime. And so I kind of started talking more about that publicly, how education access was mediated by your political ideology in Cuba, which is not talked about enough. And that especially Afro-Cubans were likely and more likely, at least in my sample, to be put in prison, experience jail time, and just were surveilled at higher rates, because for a couple reasons. One, they should be grateful for the revolution, because supposedly revolution got rid of racial discrimination. And on the other, because you're Black, you should be grateful, because you're inferior in the rest of the world, so you need to be grateful to the revolution. And so those myths and those ideologies, I found in my data. And I would, talk about how Afro-Cubans and these spiritual healers that I interviewed kind of challenged the political ideology and challenged the way that we think, Cuba opened access, especially with like the Afro-Cuban societies, right? So Afro-Cuban societies, the Sociedades de Negros, and they were banned in 1961 under Fidel Castro, even though they existed as cabildos and sociedades for hundreds and hundreds of years. And they were the center of kind of Afro-Cuban knowledge, Afro-Cuban intellectualism, Afro-Cuban scholarship. And they were banned in 61. And so you have things like Buena Vista Social Club, which is so well known internationally, but Buena Vista Social Club doesn't exist as a social club anymore and hadn't existed. These are just remnants of places that are probably one of the most marginalized places, just like San Isidro, which is where kind of the artistic movement for Cubans began in 2018 when I was there. And in 2021, they had the uprising, the July 11th uprising, where tens of thousands of Cubans took to the street and called out for freedom and said, we want a different regime. We want a change. We don't want to be repressed. We want freedom of expression, and we want a constitution that actually works for us and allows us these freedoms. And so a lot of Cubans were repressed. They were put in jail. Some Cubans, predominantly Black Cubans, were killed and disappeared, right? Because there's no data on that. The Cuban government doesn't have to collect data on police shootings. And I thought it was fascinating that finally, after 60 something years, Cubans took to the street, and the international community was pretty silent. And not only was it silent, were they silent when it came to things like racial justice activism. The Black Lives Matter organization was tone deaf and actually sided with the Cuban regime instead of siding with Afro-Cubans. And there were several Afro-Cubans, musicians, leaders that actually talked about how they were so disappointed. And this movement that's supposed to challenge police brutality and the militarization of a society against Black people, that they could side with the Cuban regime, was a slap in the face. So to me, that was a wake-up call that there are flaws and there are cracks in what we understand as global Black solidarity or Pan-Africanism. When it comes to Cuba, it seems like Afro-Cubans are a sacrificial lamb. So in order to save face globally and to say like, okay, we're all aligned with, with the leftist ways of thinking about racial solidarity, we're gonna sacrifice Afro-Cubans and say, well, it's not really a big deal. What's more important is issues of police brutality in the United States. It's, you know, what's going on in Cuba doesn't matter. Go ahead.
No, I was going to say, I remember when you were on the talk shows and news shows talking, you know, being really, very vocal, and the protests that you led. I mean, I've talked to many people in Cuba surrounding those demonstrations, and it was just really fraught with, you know, trying to, well, for me, the issue was always why people kept wanting to say, oh, it's not coming from inside. It's coming from, you know, afuera. And I was like, I don't think, like, you can't tell me that ten thousands of people are being, you know, have a puppeteer telling them what to do. That's not how that works.
Exactly. And what I find really interesting when it comes to that discourse is that we become, those of us who talk about the regime in a negative way and talk about the Cuban government in a negative way, we become targets, right? So it's not like they engage us and say, well, let's have a dialogue, right? Because they've never done that. Historically, we got to look at the evidence. They don't engage with critique. And that was the same case with me. So when I started speaking publicly about what I experienced in Cuba and what I researched in Cuba, they wrote about me in Grama. The Cuban regime wrote about me in Grama and called me an imperialist. And I'm like, I'm an imperialist? Really? Like, do you know my research? I've been studying post-colonial topics and post-colonial issues for over a decade. You know, I would never in my life align with any kind of government. You know, I'm a free agent. I can speak freely. I live in a free society. The University of Pennsylvania, the U.S. government, no one controls anything I say. And as a matter of fact, I actually went to Cuba thinking that Cuba provided all of these assets when it came to education and health, because I had believed everything that I had read, you know, in UN reports. But when you actually go to Cuba and talk to people and actually understand their experiences within the education system, you know that, yes, it may be free, but they have to give up entire lives of work history, of work, of actual labor. And so we know that with like the medical doctors. But either way, yeah, the fact that people who talk against the regime outside of the Cuban context are just seen as, oh, they, you know, they work for the CIA or they work for the UN, they're imperialists. Like, we call these names, you know, aligns with the what they've done to dissidents, you know, for decades and, you know, for over 65 years. And so It's just like a propaganda book. Like, that's, they go off that book. And so in the US, people who were silencing Afro-Cubans were kind of saying like, oh, it's the CIA, you know, because it's always the CIA, it's always the US, everything's always the US. And it's like, really? A totalitarian communist regime. Communism has fallen since the 90s. It never worked. You're saying it's not the regime. You're saying it's the US government. Does that even make sense? Do you even know kind of post-Soviet political history? Do you understand what this ideology has done to people at the global scale? Like, do we understand what the Soviets are doing now as far as Russia, Soviets, very, very similar ideologies, because, you know, Putin is still touting those same ideologies. It's just now hidden behind businesses that he controls. And but it's the same movement. It's the colonial imperialist expansion of the Soviets and the Russian ideology that's in Cuba that has been propagated by the Cuban government. And so we don't critique that, because we think Marxism is, I'm saying we as far as the left, or those of us who work in like racial justice issues, you know, there's so much scholarship that, you know, the US left has claimed that Marxism is going to save us from capitalism. And the reality is, if you look at the evidence, it didn't save anyone for anything ever. And it's actually ruining lives, many lives, and many Afro-Cubans suffer for that.
Yeah, I'm going to leave my critique over on the table, and I'm going to shift into thinking about the work that you're doing. And as you mentioned on your project, looking that is transnational in nature, is looking at Afro-Cubans in Cuba and in the U.S. And I'm wondering, I want to just talk a little bit about how that work helps us to understand that transnational piece. I think we often think, oh, this happens over there and this happens over there. But for people, for those in the African diaspora, especially the Afro-Latinos, Afro-Latinx, Afro-Latin Americans, it is really such a continuum. And so I wanted to just hear your thoughts on that.
So that I had my African, you know, I have my Afro-Cubans, I had my Cuban sample. So the lar my sample was drawn is 40. I had I interviewed 40 Cubans in Havana, and then Cubans in the United States. And so out of those 40, about 12, the larger sample was in Havana. About 12 were in the US. And of those, and of the whole sample, about 80% was Afro-Cuban. So this was largely an Afro-Cuban data set. The Afro-Cubans and the Cubans, but I would speak, I typically the Afro-Cubans in the United States were engaged in businesses. Like they for example, opened bodegas, started clubs or restaurants, worked in hotel businesses, started their own business. So I kind of looked at that and looked at the history of Afro-Cubans in the arts, especially, and saw that there is this connection to kind of Afro-Cuban philosophy, Afro-Cuban spirituality, because the bodegas, right, are extensions of these Odisha and Bantu traditions. And this is where kind of like you get like Afro-Latin New York and Harlem. A lot of it comes from these spiritual music traditions, because the music traditions that come out of Cuba, right, the song is what influences salsa, that influences the Dominicans and the Puerto Ricanos, right? Because, you know, historically, you're a historian of Cuba. We know that Cuba, at least in the Caribbean, the Spanish-speaking Caribbean, had probably the largest, you know, the largest presence of enslaved Africans because of its geographic positionality. And so you have a lot of this strong religious history that comes out in the musical and dance experiences of Cubans. And we also know a lot of Cubans, about 50% of Cubans were free during the colonial period, towards the end, towards more of the independence. You have a large free Black population, which is not the same in Puerto Rico and Dominican. So you had like a large inteligencia, a large intelligentsia community that is drawn from these Afro-Cuban religious practices, which are present in the US through the form of dance, music, botanicas, businesses. And so you see an expansion of Afro-Cubanidad in the US, where you see a shrinking of Afro-Cubanidad, especially based on the collapsing and banning of Afro-Cuban societies in Cuba, showing you that democratic systems like the United States actually enhance this cultural, these cultural experiences and traditions for Afro-Cubans, whereas in the communist state of Cuba, it retracts it and it stifles it. And so those are some of the kind of intellectual threads that I'm finding in my work that speaks to kind of education, intellectual expansion broadly.
And so thinking about that, and other areas of your work, and certainly personal life as well, what do you think are some of the most urgent issues for Afro-Latinx, Afro-Latin American, Afro-Cuban, Afro-Cubans in both spaces for these communities today?
So a couple things. One, I think that Afro-Latinidad is not a monolith. And so I'm exploring that in some work that I'm doing in quantitative ethnography now, kind of showing the literature of Afro-Latinidad in education. What we're finding is that if we were to include Afro-Latinidad in all of these Afro-Latin American countries as proxies for Afro-Latinidad, so not just looking at literature that says Afro-Latinidad or that uses the term Afro-Latinidad, and I'm talking about within education, if we were to use Cuba, Dominican Republic, and Puerto Rico also as proxies of Afro-Latinidad, because we know broadly the Afro-Latin American studies literature says, what is Afro-Latin American? Well, Afro-Latin American is the people, right? The people that have an identity that's Afro-Latin American, but it's also the geographies where enslaved people were brought in higher numbers, and also where you have had, like what I mentioned, these movements, these expansions of intellectuality, of culture, of knowledge. So Cuba, PR, and DR within the Afro-Latin American scholarship are considered Afro-Latin American geographies. And so what I've found is that when you, well, myself and my team, when you look at the proxies for Afro-Latinidad, when it's just a nation state and education, a lot of their themes are based on migration, language, economy. Race is there, but it's not as central. When you look at themes that are Afro-Latinidad based, that race is so tightly coupled, which makes sense because Afro-Latinidad comes out from a space of centering race, similar to CRT to a certain extent, centers race in this the social and cultural experiences of people from Latin America of African descent. But I think the pressing issue is, if we only look at the proxies for race and racism with terms like Afro-Latinidad, we're going to miss Afro-Latinidad in all of its expression, you know, challenging racism, and also culturally, if we don't look at proxies like Cubans, Puerto Ricans, and Dominicans, you know, Afro-Brazilians, of course, Brazilians, Colombians, Afro-Colombians, but they're not always going to use the term Afro-Latin, just like we personally don't always identify as Afro-Latin. My mother still doesn't identify as Afro-Cuban. Mm-hmm. Why? Because she thinks it's redundant. Mm-hmm. She says, I'm Cuban. And because she's also Santera, and she's been practicing Afro-Cuban religions since she was a young woman, she sees it as redundant. And so there's always this idea like, okay, well, are we being anti-Black if we're not claiming this Afro? And it's like, well, that could be, you know, we know the history. Yeah, it could be. But it's also, it's a yes and. Yes, it could be anti-Black. And culturally, there's some who identify primarily with their nation state. And we know the research, you know, Wendy Roth's work on racial schemas bears that out. You know, it shows that Dominicans and Puerto Ricans tend to identify with their basic national racial schema of being Puerto Rican and Dominican primarily. Mm-hmm. Even though they may be of African descent. And we know the census, you know, when you look at how Afro-Latinos identify, you know, the census counts 2.2 million who checked Latino and Black box. Mm-hmm. But do you know how many Afro-Latinos there are in the United States? Over 6 million. So only about 60%. There's 60 something percent that aren't even counted because we don't check boxes. Well, for multiple reasons.
Right. Yes. For multiple reasons, for sure. But yeah, but there's that whole undercounting then. That people don't are, you know, people are falling through the cracks in certain space, especially when we think about research and the way that the data doesn't look at them, doesn't disaggregate. And so, yeah.
And I just think it's difficult. I mean, you know, African-Americans in the United States identify as Black or African-American, but even that has had its waves, right? There was moments mm-hmm. where in the history of being African-American, you were like, I'm not African-American, I'm Black. Because that meant something different, right? Like, I wasn't mm-hmm. born in Africa. Like, mm-hmm. I'm Black, right? So it's same for Afro-Latinos. It's not that they don't want to be Black. It's just they don't see themselves as having the same experiences as African-Americans. And so mm-hmm. Blackness in the United States is kind of always couched within that primary racialization. And they see their Dominicanness, their Puerto Ricanness, their Cubanidad culturally as different. And so mm-hmm. I'm not saying anything new. I think there was a book called Beyond... It was called More Than Black from Sheila Scholar in Tampa that did work on Afro-Cubans in Tampa. Mm-hmm. And she found similar things that if we only look at race or these ideas of race based on kind of the U.S. construct of race, mm-hmm. you're going to miss understanding Blackness as an Africanness from a perspective that's really tied to these ancestral traditions in Cuba and Dominican Republic and Santo Domingo and other countries mm-hmm. that are different historically because we had different colonial histories as well.
Yeah, I was just reading, it'll come to me later, but reading and thinking about how Blackness is not monolithic either. That there's just, I mean, just look around.
But regionally.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So we have to really kind of come out of that box of that Blackness is only one way, one thing, when we know that it is so many things with even within nation states, there's all kinds of ways that Blackness is performed, presented, the way people identify. And so I think the more that we can see that, the I think in some ways the clearer it will be the connections within the diaspora. But we have, you know, ways to go.
We do. And honestly, I feel like and so is it a pressing issue that I think we have to acknowledge, and even through the research, at least my research is acknowledging that flexibility, that breath, right? Mm-hmm. And I think we need breath, and we need to say, okay, we're going to look at Afro-Latinidad from this perspective, but we're also going to look at it from this perspective as well. We're going to accept Afro-Latinos who live in these Afro-Latin societies, although may not identify as kind of Black U.S. standard Black, right? Mm-hmm. You have to be, because these people may not even speak English. So they can't even interpret it, or they may not even check the Latino box. We don't even know how And the class dynamics of that, the migration, mm-hmm. we know that Afro-Latinos tend to be, 50, I think 50% is foreign born. So they have different schemas in their own home country. And mm-hmm. in the U.S., it's just different when they engage in these kind of census debates. But I think it's beyond the census to me because my work is local. I do work in Philly. I didn't even mention my Philly work, which is also looking at Afro-Latinos and, you know, Puerto Rican Afro-Latinos. But, you know, what I have found is that when you ask, at least my North Philly project, I interviewed 73 participants in the housing community, predominantly Afro-Latino based on street race. Because when mm-hmm. I asked them, I said, I identify as Afro-Cuban. How do you identify? They said Puerto Rican, mm-hmm. Dominican, mm-hmm. Puerto Rican, Dominican. They did not say Afro-Latino. Mm-hmm. Right. And the one that did say was younger. Mm-hmm. And so I think there's generational differences in how, you know, how people identify with Afro-Latinidad. I know it's becoming more popular in the last, you know, 20 years. But I think that's going to be a pressing issue as far as in the scholarship and in, you know, in how we address policy issues in education, understanding that this community is not easily captured within census. So how do we best address their needs? Within schools, within college campuses. And to me, I think I would suggest looking at kind of nation state, foreign born data, and looking at the geographies, the histories of the geographies, looking at the communities that have lived in these cities for generations and the needs and the contributions that they've had to these cities, you know, in Philly in particular, in New York, absolutely. That's like the Afro-Latin city of the United States, Miami, Tampa. But like thinking of it from a more spatial geographic perspective, historical perspective, I think also adds to these gaps in identity mm-hmm. that we're always going to have.
Mm-hmm. Well, as I kind of get to my last question that I always like to ask is, you know, in addition to the work that you do, and certainly you mentioned lots of different resources throughout our conversation, and we'll put those on the podcast webpage. What other specific kind of resources would you recommend for people who were like, oh, I want to know more about this Afro-Cubans or Afro-Latinidad in education? How, you know, what would you recommend that they check out?
So as you mentioned, the Afro-Cuban work that I've, you know, the Afro-Cuban ethnography, all of this, you know, in academia, it takes a million years to publish and yes. to get out.
Yes, indeed.
So, you know, the good thing is media is great and I've gotten a lot of media attention, as you mentioned. So I've been on, there's a podcast that I did with Jason Johnson, a Slate podcast on Afro-Cubans. And I think it's called Afro-Cubans on the Brink. Mm-hmm. And so there, similar to here, I talk orally about the, you know, Afro-Cuban societies and how they were banned in Cuba. There were over 500 where now they none of them exist. And so kind of learning more about that history, you can learn about that from that podcast. I think Carlos Moore's book is essential. Castro, the Blacks in Africa. Carlos Moore was a student of Maya Angelou's. He was someone who actually supported Fidel Castro for a couple of years when he was in Harlem. And he's Cuban of Jamaican descent, Afro-Cuban of Jamaican descent. And he went to Cuba and was exiled because Fidel Castro wouldn't allow a Black man like Carlos Moore, an intellectual like Carlos Moore, to be leading anything in Cuba related to race. And so, like most Blacks in the Cuban regime, were exiled, imprisoned, or killed. And so his scholarship is instrumental to understand about to understand the flaws of the Cuban regime and Marxism and communism in Cuba and the experiences of Blacks in Cuba. I think that's probably the most seminal text I could recommend.
Okay, wonderful. Thank you so much for taking the time to talk with us. I'm looking forward to all the things that are coming out with your research and thank you for sharing your journey with us.
You're welcome. Thank you so much. This is so, so enjoyable, so fruitful. I enjoyed this conversation so much.
Thanks for listening. Be sure to subscribe and hear more episodes of Dialogues in Afro-Latinidad on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and YouTube. And go to michellereedvasquez.com to check out our episode resources and learn more about the Afro-Latinidad Studies Institute.